Love science. And we'll take your calls. Our special guest tonight, Dr. Hakeem Olusheyi, as we talk about things in science. His website, by the way, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you with Dr. Hakeem Olusheyi as we talk about all things space. And, Doctor, I'm fascinated by your name because in Arabic it does mean doctor. Were your parents in the medical field or anything like that?
No, you know, I actually changed my name, so I selected my own name.
All right, Doctor. I was asking you about Earth-like planets and how many you think could be out there where they're, they call it the Goldilocks zone, close to its star, it's got water, it's got an atmosphere. What do you think?
So when we talk about Earth-like planets, typically, we're talking about planets that are in the habitable zone. That means that if they were, if they had an atmosphere like the Earth, liquid water could exist on the surface, and that they have a similar mass and radius to the Earth, right? Now, after that, you really don't know, right? You don't really know what the atmosphere is made of. So,
right,
for example,
right.
Venus could be, an Earth-like planet, but of course, you can't live on Venus. You know, the atmosphere and the temperatures makes it just too hot.
That's right.
Yeah, and Mars also, could be a great candidate for life, but then again, it's too cold, the atmosphere is so thin, the atmospheric composition is all wrong. So, once you have Earth-like planets in the habitable zone, that's only the beginning of the story. But, it's not the whole story. So if you take, for example, moons around Jupiter and Saturn, there are several that are candidates for life. Now, instead of having a surface ocean, right, they have a frozen surface.
And because it's too cold out there, right?
It's so cold, exactly. You're so far from the star, the sun. And instead of having an ocean on the surface, you have an ocean on the interior, right? And the heating comes from tidal flexing. As you orbit Jupiter, the planet bends and flexes, and that causes the core to melt. And so on Io, which is the closest moon to Jupiter, of Jupiter's moons, Io is the closest,
mm-hmm.
It has so much tidal heating that it's covered in volcanoes, right? But you go out a little bit, you now have Europa, which has an internal ocean and a frozen surface. Could it have tidal heating in its interior? Could it have the materials that could lead to life being there? So on the one hand, having planets in the habitable zone is sort of like, oh, yeah, there are lots of them. And then you say, well, we got to cut that back because the conditions are just aren't enough. So then you reduce the number significantly. And then, though, you can add more because there are planets that could be outside the habitable zone that could harbor life. So, it's one of these things where we just don't know. And, there are several phenomena. For example, the four-minute mile. People thought it was impossible to run a mile in 4 minutes. But then once someone did it,
Somebody did it. That's right. They all jumped on board.
Exactly. And when you start finding planets, can we find planets around other stars? It seems so difficult. But then once you do it, now they're everywhere. It's easy to find them. Now, perhaps we're going to find life soon, maybe in our solar system, maybe using biosignatures from a planet outside our solar system. And when we do, that's going to open another door. And you could imagine that the same thing would happen, right? We'd start finding life everywhere.
Is it safe to assume that with the complexity of life, that the primordial soup throughout the universe is the same, that the elements are the same?
That's one of the questions that people have been actively investigating. Are the chemical elements the same pretty much everywhere? Are the laws of physics the same everywhere and throughout all time? And so far, that appears to be the case.
So every planet might have gold, oxygen, hydrogen, all the elements. They could be there. Carbon.
Yeah. One key thing is, there's this big hot thing in the center of our solar system. And so when you look at, the composition of planets, of bodies, as you move from the interior to the exterior, it changes because the temperature changes. So the same thing happens on Earth, right? If you look at the continent Antarctica, it's very different from the continent of Africa, right? Because the temperature is just so different. And not only does the temperature change, but also the chemical composition change. Certain elements just can't exist close to the star, and certain elements will be more abundant farther away from the star. Like, one question we have is, how did water come to the Earth? You know, in some ideas of how the Earth formed, all the water would have been boiled off, and so it would have had to come via asteroids or comets. And one way you can tell is by looking at the type of hydrogen that we have in our water here on Earth. And so under certain conditions, you have a certain type of hydrogen, right? There's another type called deuterium. It's still hydrogen, but it just has an extra neutron. So we look at the ratio of the deuterium type hydrogen to regular hydrogen, and that would change, you know, as you look at the distance from the sun. So the asteroids would have a very different ratio than, say, comets. And so one question we have is, you know, did water come to Earth via comets, or did it come via asteroids?
Now, as a scientist, do you factor in at all the God factor?
Well, anything that is observable and can be put down in equations is what's factored in. Anything and everything that we can think of. So we don't yet have, you know, observational tests or theoretical models of how to factor this in. So what we do is, you know, we have the basic laws of physics and chemistry, you know, this is how we approach it, right? So we allow the universe to tell us. We don't, you know, we don't tell the universe anything, right? So typically, you know, there's a thing that happens, you know, when you're talking with your friends, where they'll say, oh, here's a mystery, and we don't know the answer there, so, you know, let's place God there, right? The God of the gaps is how they talk about that philosophically. But as scientists, you know, if you don't know the answer, you just leave it as, we don't know the answer there, right? And the way that you do science is, you know, you come up with these ideas that you write down in equations that allow you to make predictions, right? So It's not about finding an explanation for why things are the way they are. You find a model or a theory, as we call it. Now, theory to regular people means like a guess, right? In science, it doesn't mean that. Theory is the highest state of knowledge. And theory is represented by these equations. And with these equations, I can predict things that no one has ever seen before or even thought of before, and then I can make an experiment and go and look and see if that prediction holds true. And if it does, then, hey, this theory is still correct to the extent that it has been tested. But if it doesn't hold true, then the theory or model is definitely incorrect or incomplete.
All right, Doctor, let's take some calls here for the rest of the hour.
All right.
We'll start by going to Joe in the Bronx on Coast to Coast AM. Hi, Joseph.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good.
I'd like to ask the doctor if space-time, as far as it compares to Earth time, what are the differences between the two?
So when we talk about space-time, this is something that Albert Einstein gave us. So we think we're in space, right? It has three dimensions, length, width, and height. And Albert Einstein said, no. In fact, there's four dimensions. Time is just like space in a way. And here's how that manifests itself. So time is not something that is always the same, and neither is a distance. So here's something that's going to blow your mind. At all times, you, me, and everything else is moving through space-time at the speed of light. We can't stop. But because you and I are not moving very fast relative to each other through space, then all of our movement is through time together. So we're moving at the speed of light through time, you and I. Now, say, for example, you were to move very fast through space and go visit another star. Because you must always move at the speed of light, some of it through space, some of it through time, because you're moving so fast through space, you must necessarily now move much slower through time than I am, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you will come back to Earth, and maybe 5 years will have passed to you, but on Earth it could be 1,000 years.
Oh, my God. If there's even a planet to come back to.
Yeah, I mean, this is real. This is something that we observe every day as scientists. You know, Albert Einstein discovered it. It sounds wild, but it's absolutely 100% observed to be true. So when we say, for example, the age of the universe, that doesn't really make a lot of sense, because not only does speed change the passage of time, so does gravity. So there's areas in the universe where there's lots and lots of galaxies, and then there's areas in the universe where there are almost no galaxies that we call voids. So time moves faster in the voids than it does where there are galaxies, right? So, you know, time passes at different rates based on how you're moving. And so, you know, space and time are intertwined
Multiverses, do they exist?
They have not been observed to exist. So, you know, today when you walk around with your smartphone and something happens and you go home and tell your friends, today they say, if there's not a picture, it didn't happen, right? In physics, if it isn't observed to be true, it's not accepted as true. Now, multiverses are now taken way more seriously than they were in the past. Because think about it, right? At one time, we thought there was only one planet, the Earth, and we were at the center, and it was at the center of the universe. Now we know it's just one planet among many, and our star is just one star among hundreds of billions. So think about it. Let's take that to the next level. We call it a universe. There is only one, and it is the one that we are in. That sounds pretty, you know, self-centered, right? So philosophically, perhaps it's a bit distasteful to have a universe, and it might be more tasteful to have multiverses. But yet and still, taste aside, we have not observed multiverses to be true.
How about dimensions? Do they exist?
Well, we have our three dimensions of space and our fourth dimension, which is of time, and certain ideas of, you know, the fundamental nature of existence, like M theory and, you know, form of string theory, suggest that our universe has many more dimensions that are spatial, but they're so small that we can't observe them. And then there are ideas of higher dimensions that and parallel universes. You know, so these are wonderful ideas. There's a lot of literature on the topic. There's actual real scientific research on the topics. And again, the key is, if they are true, can you make a prediction of something that we can go and observe today experimentally and see if your prediction holds true? Like, what would be the signature of these multiverses that we can measure? And then we can go and look. And if we see that signature, then, hey, that thing is held up for that one test. Let's go on and have some more tests. But if it doesn't hold up, then it doesn't, you know, if you contrast that with something like the Big Bang or our models of the atoms, you know, those things, they every time we observe the crazy prediction. So multiverse and these sort of things haven't yet, you know, been so successful.
Let's go to Robert in Spokane, Washington on our wildcard line. Robert, hello there.
Hello, doctor.
Hello.
I have a question about the universe I've always been wondering about.
Yeah.
When we look out in the night sky, we see a rough glow circling us, which is the visible edge of the universe, about, what, 13.5 billion years away?
Well, you really can't see that, but, I mean, when you look up, you know, from Earth, you can only see maybe 6,000 stars with the naked eye, and there are really close stars. We're in a system of 400 billion, and you can only see around 6,000 because space is so big.
Well, I'm actually talking about what we are discovering is the observable limit of the universe.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing.
Back to the beginning.
Yeah, so the universe is expanding, right? So when we look at the most distant light that we can see, the cosmic microwave background radiation, going back 13 billion years.
Right.
Almost 13.5 billion years, right.
Okay, so now we, somewhere out there, there must be, I'm talking about present day now, not 13.5 billion years ago, but there must be a star out there with people on it.
To me,
let's assume there is, okay?
Yeah. That's highly unlikely that there would be people. There's not, you know, when we talk about Earth's twin, like, you know, the idea of finding a planet that would have the same mass, same kind of star at the same distance with the same chemical composition in the atmosphere and the oceans and so forth and so on, and then the evolution of life on that planet to follow the same pathway, the probability of all that happening is really small.
Well, I'm really saying intelligence.
Yeah, so now is there intelligence? Now, that's a good question, right? Now,
I assume there is, though.
I assume there is.
Statistically, okay. I would imagine that there's so much, that even if the probability is really small, the possibility is so high that, you know, you would imagine it would happen.
Right.
But again, we haven't observed it, and that's the thing. You know, when it comes to life and intelligence, it's hard for us to because we don't know how it's formed. We don't know so much about the process of forming life and then it evolved. Because if you look at life on our own planet, for example, we've observed life to exist here for 3.8 billion years out of the 4.5 billion our planet has existed. But 300 billion of that 3.8 billion, life has just been single-celled.
Yeah. Well, doctor, let me get to my question now.
Yeah.
Okay.
we have that intelligence out there. Now, when they look back at us, what do they see? They would probably see us at the limit of their observable universe about 13.5 billion years ago, correct?
Well, our star and planet didn't exist 13.8 billion years
ago. It didn't, but they would see our region of space as it was back then.
That's right. Distance and time were intertwined. That's right.
So now when they turn and look 180 degrees away from us, what do they see?
Well, it's everywhere in the universe, there is a sphere that you can see around you where the light has reached you. Now, take into account now that space is expanding. So you, when you receive that light, the location where that light originated is now has been carried much, much farther away.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the horizon, we call that in cosmology, the co-moving distance, is over 40 billion light years away, right? So the light travel time might be 13 billion, but the current distance is more like 40 billion.
Doctor, before there was first light,
yes,
what was there?
So define first light. So there's the first light when stars turn on, and then there's the first light at the very origin of the universe, right? And so these things are separated, we think, by about a billion years, these events.
Those first lights in the origin, where would they come from? What would be its source?
So in space, there is matter and energy, just in empty space. And we observe, so, you know, again, people had this idea of what if this exists, what could you see? And so there are certain observable things we see. So, for example, there are these particles that pop into and out of existence, matter, antimatter particles. They're happening everywhere in space, inside you, inside me, right in front of your face, everywhere. And people say, okay, if they exist, they will have electric fields. And those electric fields would have an influence on the atoms that we use experimentally.
Mm-hmm.
And they will have a predictable effect on measurements that we make of those atoms. Can we go and measure that predictable effect? And in fact, you do, right? It's called the Lamb shift of the hydrogen spectrum.
Was there ever a void of total darkness?
Well, yeah. So after the hydrogen in the universe formed, almost 400,000 years after the universe formed, came into existence, there's what we call the Dark Ages, which a lot of people, a lot of scientists now are studying the Dark Ages. This is the time period between which the primordial plasma ball, we called it, when the entire universe was this big giant, you know, hot plasma. And when the first stars turned on, we had these dark ages, and that was it. It was dark except for, the light that fills all space, which is left over from the origin of the universe.
We're going to come back and take final calls in a moment, and then I've got the $64,000 question for you, Doctor, so hang on. And welcome back to Coast. Neil Slade's going to join us next hour as we talk about some brain power stories. Then we'll have open lines on Coast to Coast. We're with our special guest, Dr. Hakeem Olishaili, and it's our final segment with the doctor. And doctor, if people want to get a hold of you, do you take emails?
Yes. If you Google my name, or you can find me on Twitter, Hakeem Olishaili, and if you can remember Hakeem, H-A-K-E-E-M, and put physics or astronomy into a browser search window, then you'll
get the rest comes in.
Yeah.
Now, the big question.
Yes, sir.
How did all this start, the universe? How could something start from nothing? Who put it together? How'd this happen?
You know, it turns out that you don't actually require a who. The universe, the way it's designed, the nature of space gives rise to matter and energy. And so the question is, how did that space get there in the first place, right? And that's not something that we have an answer for, because everybody thinks that the Big Bang is the origin of everything there is. But the reality is you actually need energy and space in order for a Big Bang to come into existence. So that kind of is one of the evidences that there may be multiverses. And once you have rapidly expanding space, you get everything else. And so we are looking for this event called inflation in a very early universe. If this inflationary epoch occurred, and currently all data suggest it did, but we haven't directly observed it. But there is a predictable observation we could make that allows us to falsify it, but it's technically incredibly difficult. And again, it's made by by observing that light that's left over from the origin of the universe, the cosmic microwave background radiation. But there's a signal in it. It's called the B-mode polarization of the cosmic microwave background radiation, right? Doesn't mean a lot to you, but I just say the name to know that it's a real something that we can observe.
When you look at Genesis in the Bible, mm-hmm. and go through the synopsis of the 7 days, mm-hmm. and what was made on the first day and the second day, and you know, then when God rested on the last day, it's amazing how right they have it in terms of the chronology of science.
My understanding is a bit different, that some things aren't in the same order as we observe. I don't remember exactly right now because I haven't looked at the comparison recently, but that's my recollection, right? Sometimes you draw a conclusion but don't remember exactly the details, but that's my recollection.
Will we ever really get the answers that we're all seeking?
Well, we can always ask the questions. And, you know, when you ask the questions, you don't know what you're going to end up with. And so, for example, you know, just understanding the universe, when people were seeking to understand, you know, why the ratio of hydrogen to helium was as it is in the universe, that gave birth to the Big Bang. When people were seeking to understand how things like electrons move, that gave rise to the science of quantum mechanics, which gave rise to the cell phone that you use every day, and all the computer chips that you use every day. So the key thing for us as a nation is to make sure that we're investing in science vigorously, because those that do that, those that explore those nations, they are the ones that innovate, they are the ones that remain healthy, and they are the ones that ultimately win.
Let's go back to the calls now. First-time caller Stephen in Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Thank you for the format that you put here.
You're welcome.
First question, and I hope you can hear me well.
Yep, so far so good.
All right. A theory that I came up with is God is gas. When we're asking the questions of how did we become into our existence, it starts with hydrogen and water and carbon. And then we've become this ability where we can make airplanes go past the speed of sound. Never heard, what an incredible show. So I made a list here real quick.
All right.
Hydrogen is the most abundant substance in the universe, from what I understand.
Yes. True.
And we're built, we have to have water. We have to have water. We have to have carbon. That's what makes up our bodies. Now, another thing, I'm an electrician, and I study the ability to transfer electricity through lines all across the United States. And there's a thing called the Thunderbolts Project that is starting to look at a new way of looking at the universe. And it's based on electricity, but that's the driving force. And your gentleman there that is on the show with you, I wonder what he thinks of the Thunderbolts projects.
Are we aware of this, Dr. Hakim?
No, I've never heard of this project.
Can you tell us a little bit more, Stephen?
Yes, sir. The Thunderbolts projects, as opposed to gravity, it says that electricity, electrons, runs the universe. It used to be that gravity, the holy grail of physics was gravity and understanding.
Right. I would think so.
And I've taken a bowl of water and put a matchstick in the bowl of water, and then I would take a small shot glass and dump it in, and the matchstick would swallow in to the water. And that's one of the things in physics that is not completely understood. It's gravity. And I think it's a combination of the two. It's electricity and then the warping of space.
Well, there is an electric universe out there, Doctor.
Well, listen, you know, like I said before, you know, at our scale, so the thing about there are four fundamental forces, right? The strong force, the weak force, gravity, and the electricity and magnetism. And the thing about electricity and magnetism and gravity is that they have an infinite reach, whereas the strong force and the weak force only work over incredibly short distances, so they take place in the nucleus of atoms only. So gravity is, so if you look at the evolution of the universe, the strong force is the strongest, so the universe went neutral under the strong force first. And what do I mean by go neutral? If you hold out something at arm's distance and you let it go, it falls. It falls to the ground. Now, if you were to do that in space, it would just stay where you release it. Now, and space is most places in the universe. So why does it move by itself and go to the ground? That's because of this gravity force. It wants to neutralize. It wants to get rid of that distance between the Earth and the sun. Excuse me, the Earth, the object and the ground. And what happens is that the universe has been going neutral under these forces. So first it went neutral under the strong force, the very early ages of the universe, in what's called baryogenesis and nucleosynthesis. And then it went neutral under electricity and magnetism, and what we call recombination, that gave that set the cosmic microwave background radiation free. And it's still going neutral under the gravitational force. Things are still falling together, right? And it's only when things have combined as much as they can and the expansion of space has taken everything away from itself that process will stop. And so what this means is, on our everyday lives, it is that electromagnetic force. When your car burns gasoline, that is due to the action of the electromagnetic force. When you sit on the chair and that chair is stiff and you don't fall through it, you know, all of this stuff, atoms and molecules being held together, is all electromagnetic. So in a very real way, the electromagnetic force does dominate our lives.
All right, let's go to Mike now in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Mike, go ahead.
How you doing?
Good,
Mike. I want to talk about Dr. Ben Rich. I know there have been many guests on your program in the past who discussed him. Former head of Lockheed Skunk Works and the stealth fighter plane. He died 20 years ago. Before he died, he left a deathbed confession. And he said, we took alien ships, crashed UFOs, copied them, and we have our own ships out there now exploring the galaxy. This is what he said in his deathbed confession, all right?
All right.
The technology is there. We've been out there. Now, since that 20-year period, is there any evidence proving this? And I think there is. Recently, astronomers, like your guest, have said there are over 2,000 Earth-like planets out in the galaxy. How do they know this? Well, they look through a telescope here on Earth, they see a planet 1,000 light years away, and they say, hey, it's Earth-like. Doesn't make any sense. But if we have ships out there that are landing on those planets and taking tests on those planets, we know for sure they're Earth-like. And I think that's the evidence showing that Ben Rich knew what he was talking about. When these astronomers keep telling us all these Earth-like planets are out there, they're not getting the information from telescopes. They're getting it from other sources.
Let's find out. What do you think of that, Hakeem?
Well, you definitely can tell planets are Earth-like with telescopes. And when we say Earth-like, it doesn't mean like Earth. So what happens is when a planet, if you were looking at say, for example, a light, and something passed in front of the light, you could see its silhouette, right? And that's what we see with planets. They pass in front of the star along our line of sight that they're orbiting, right? They do it over and over as they go around, and we keep seeing this dip in the brightness of the star. Well, you can examine that dip in the brightness, and you can tell the size of the planet. And then, based on the time it takes the planet to orbit that star, you can tell the masses of the objects. And based on the masses, once you have the mass and the size, you now know the density, right? And that density gives you an indication of what it's made of. Now, typically, when we say Earth-like, what that means is that the mass and the size is around the same mass and size as Earth, and the density is around the same density as rock, and it also has a surface temperature potentially that is similar, such that Earth could, excuse me, such that water could exist on the surface of that planet. But it doesn't mean that it has life. It doesn't mean that we know much about its atmosphere. You know, it doesn't mean that there are beings living there. It just means in the very broadest strokes, the right size, you know, the right density and the right distance. And that's it. And let me tell you something else. Big scientific conspiracies are, they don't happen. And the reason why is because everybody wants to be the smart person, right? And so, you know, there is no incentive whatsoever with going along with anything. If I prove someone wrong, right, then, you know, I'm a scientific hero. If I know more than Newton or Einstein, right, I'm the greatest scientific mind that ever existed. So we're all undercutting each other every moment. You know, if you've ever met a real nerd, they correct even the slightest error in what you say, right? We like to call it the well actually guy, right? You say something and the well actually guy, well actually, right? They you know, so these conspiracies cannot exist just because of the humans, how they are, and the culture of science. When I say something, here's what really happens. You work on something for years, and then you present it to your colleagues, and they rip you a new one.
Yes,
right?
They do.
They tear you apart every single time. So the stuff that makes it into the books is stuff that has survived an incredible onslaught of hate from all the scientists that in the world, right? So that's my answer.
Let's go to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. He happens to be an amateur astronomer. Hi, Bill.
Yes. Hi, George. Yes. Hi, Doctor. Let me get right to my question. I am an atheist as well as an amateur astronomer, as George knows. And the reason I say I'm an atheist is George, as well as you brought up, especially George, religion, spirituality, and even Genesis, which is irrational and mythical, does not relate to astronomy and cosmology. But my question to you is about the Copernican principle. The Copernican principle, which is a hallmark of astronomy and cosmology, as it relates to religion and spirituality. It negates religion, God, spirituality, and Christ. In other words, the Copernican principle, which, as you know, is our planet Earth is not special. We're not in the center of the universe. Neither is our solar system special. In fact, our galaxy is not special. And if the multiverse is true, our universe is not necessarily special. So therefore, how can one part of our planet, meaning the Middle East, meaning Israel, or the Mount of Olives, where so-called Jesus, so-called lived or died, is so-called the most important place in the cosmos. That's utterly ridiculous. So what do you think of what I said regarding the Copernican principle negating religion and spirituality?
Well, you know, you're mixing science and faith, right? So here's my take on it, right? We have faith where, you know, in our country, you're free to choose whatever faith you wish. And that says a lot right there. You're free to choose, right? But science isn't that way, right? We come together and we agree on what we have observed to be true. And if you say that, you know, you see something different, then it has to be scientifically proven, right? Now, faith traditions aren't that way. It's like, go ahead, do whatever you want, right? And, you know, so I don't find it to be productive to attack people's faith. You know, I find it, you know, for me, I like to say, okay, here's what we observe to be true about the universe. Here is what nature is as we observe it. Here is what science is, which is something that humans do, right? Science is what humans do. Here's how it works. Here's what we have observed to be true. So no matter where you go on Earth, right, force equals mass times acceleration, E equals MC squared. But as you travel around the world, faith traditions change drastically. Now, why would I get into a debate with someone about their faith? It's something that they're free to choose. You know, choose it. Go ahead, choose it. But what I won't allow them to do is say, hey, you claim that you observe this to be true, that the universe began this process called the Big Bang. And I'm going to say, yo, hold up. You know, you can make that claim, but you have to tell me exactly why, right? Is our observation of the cosmic microwave background radiation incorrect or wrong in some way? Is our understanding of nucleosynthesis incorrect or wrong in some way? You know, it is based on observations, right? So let's do science where it's science and let human culture and that thing be what it is, you know?
Doctor, I want to thank you for your years of service in the Navy. 9 years for me there, too.
The Navy was wonderful for me. It was in the Navy where I first learned mathematics well that allowed me to become a scientist today.
Good for you.
So, you know, my father served in the Army. My brother served, my younger brother served in the Navy. And I also went to the Navy directly out of high school.
Did you ever use a slide rule, or did you have little handhelds by that time?
I had little handhelds, but I've had friends who had slide rules who thought they were the bee's knees and just wanted to share them with me. But, you know, I'd like to also say that, you know, I'm going back into service. I'm joining NASA starting October 1st.
Are you?
At NASA headquarters. That's right.
You have to keep in touch. You've got to be one of our sources, if you would.
I'm going to be the man, right? I'm joining the government, so.
You'll be the one. Okay, thank you, Doctor. Appreciate you being on the program. Up next, Neil Slade joins us. We're going to talk a little bit about brain power. And then in our final hour, it'll be open lines here on Coast to Coast AM.